So that sometimes happens. You're giving a talk and you're really putting energy into it, and then people leave. And I think, oh my goodness, my talks aren't good enough. I'm hopeless. Maybe I should find another career at this time of my life. And then they say, no, we're just going to the toilet, Ajahn Brahm. I've just got to go. But isn't it interesting just that some innocent things happen in our life, and we always interpret that as a fault. There is something wrong with me, that I am to blame. And this is one of the subjects I'm going to start with anyway of this evening's talk. I am not good enough. Are you good enough? For me, and for most people, I was always told when I was young, you are not good enough. So I tried very hard, and I just did really well at primary school, and I got a scholarship to a big secondary school in London. But not good enough. You had to do really well in your O-levels. Try harder. Put up the grades. And so I tried really hard and I passed. Was good enough? No. A-levels. Go to university. Get a good degree. Good enough? No. Get a PhD. Good enough? No. Get a Nobel Prize. Oh, come on. That's raising things a bit too high. But have you ever noticed that in our world, no matter what you achieve, no matter how high you go, you're still not good enough? And recently I gave a talk in Sydney Olympic Park, and they were talking about the Australian swimmer, Grant Hackett, you know, didn't he win gold medals in the Olympic Games? Really top of his field. But, you know, it looks like he has had some emotional problems recently. Was in the news. Hope I got it right. And why is it that somebody gets so high and then they tend to lose it? Why was it that Robin Williams, a great comedian, he committed suicide because he thought he wasn't good enough? And these are people who you think, at least these people, really successful, really sort of admired, lots of followers. Why do they think they are not good enough? Look at me, I'm a very well-known monk now. So, but am I good enough? No. I think I should give a better talk. Find some better jokes. But can I? No, there's only a limited number of jokes around. And anyway, like somebody's told the jokes today, that there's some people look at me and my tummy and they said, well, you know, you should do more exercise. But I do exercise. I do exercise a lot. So, you know, I push the envelope sometimes with some of the things I say and some of my language and my jokes. And you know, I stretch my mouth. I always do 10 push-ups every morning. There's lots of exercise which you do, but we always think, no, it's not good enough. And a long time ago I started realizing, doesn't matter how much you try to please others, it doesn't matter just what they expect of you. You can never satisfy or reach what other people ask of you. And so, there's a time I stopped trying to please other people. There's a time I stopped worrying about what other people think of me. And that's why I recognize this a wonderful saying, which is so accurate, that when you are young, usually, you know, from 15 to maybe about 25, 30, you know, you have to be fashionable. You have to dress cool. You have to know the special language. I heard somebody say the other day about their son, whenever they asked them, how are you going at school? The answer was, Nanya. And they asked, no, how are you going with your girlfriend? Nanya. And they asked him, how are you feeling today? Nanya. I never heard that word before. You know what it means? It's short for none of your business. So you have to be cool and use cool words. So if you go home tonight and the policeman stops you and have you been drinking? Nanya. I should not encourage you. But you know, you have to be really cool. But there comes a time in life when, you know, the girl should stop dressing up. It's just too much pain having to put makeup on and dresses which are really uncomfortable. And doing your hair all the time. What are you doing that for? Pleasing other people? So I never do my hair before I do the talk here. So I don't see why you should. And so there comes a time when you got what we call self-confidence. You just go and do it. You don't care what other people think of you. But some people actually, they even dress to upset people. You know, like the punk movement, remember the punks? Yeah, they were dressed particular to try and really upset and get you angry and upset. And I remember this story about, I think the subway in New York. There was, you know, this old man sitting opposite one of these punks. You know, just spiky hair, about 20 different colours, and just razor blades, you know, coming from his ears. His clothes were just, you know, really multicoloured, just, you know, really need a pair of sunglasses to look at him. And there were just piercings all over his face. And then there's a guy opposite him, you know, just, you can't help, he's right in front, you have to look at him. And so the punk shouted out, "What are you looking at, old man?" I said, "Oh, just, you know, just you. Didn't you ever do anything, you know, a bit sort of outrageous when you were young?" "Oh, yes, it, I did. When I was in the Navy, I had sex with a parrot. I thought you might be my son." That's not true. Please don't go and write to the Buddhist Society and complain. It's only a joke, okay? I don't really hate parrots. But anyway, sometimes people do outrageous things just to upset people. But you know, after a while, you just, you know, don't worry what other people think of you, and that's usually in your middle age. And then you finally find out, and I hope you find this out earlier like I did. When you're young, you're worried what other people think of you. Middle age, you don't care what other people think of you. In your older years, you finally figure out that people weren't thinking about you anyway. So that means you just do whatever you like, just forget about what other people say about you. And it's also when people say you're not good enough, you can try harder, oh, you know, you need to improve. That's something in life which really I object to. Improve. All your life you have to improve. You have to, you know, look at your figure. I look at my figure every day. I can't miss it. And you have to learn new things. Why? Why do you need to improve yourself? I asked that question. Aren't you good enough already? Who said you're not good enough? Usually your mother, your friends, your partner in life. The problem is we believe them. And because we believe what other people say about us, or what our culture says about us, if you are not going on holidays overseas, if you're not fit and got a partner who's really hot or really just cool. It's amazing, isn't it? Being hot is good or being cool is good. I can't understand which one I'm supposed to be. the opposite end of the spectrum. Because in Buddhism, we're not hot. You know, Buddhist women aren't hot. Guys aren't cool. We're in the middle way somewhere. We're temperate. Why are we trying so hard to be these things? Why do we need to improve? And a lot of times I say that that's one of the causes for a lack of self-esteem, for a lack of self-worth. You know, that, you know, we're always trying to improve. We actually literally hate who we are. Literally hate who we are and want to be somebody else. And that doesn't make any sense to me. If you hate other people, your boss, you know, your mother-in-law, you know, as pre-mothers-in-law. I don't know why I always say mother-in-law, but there's so many jokes about mother-in-law. One of my favourite mother-in-law jokes was this guy who said, "Oh, you know, my mother-in-law, she comes over to our house for Christmas every year. She's coming to our house for Christmas for the last 20 years. But this year we made an exception. We decided to let her into the house." She's coming round every 20 years. Okay, that's cool. I should improve my jokes, but they're good enough for me. In other words, you don't judge yourself because other people. You don't judge yourself, which means you don't judge other people. A long time ago, there was a book coming around our monastery down in Serpentine. I don't know if it's still there. It was in German. It'd be great if it was translated into English. I don't know if it's been done. But one of our German monks, German-born monks, you know, he sort of read it out to me in translation. It was a story of a young boy in Germany who had an out-of-the-body experience, you know, just floating out of your body, near-death experience. He was only about 7 or 8 years of age. And the reason I remembered it was, you know, because of what this little boy learned from that out-of-the-body experience. You know, he was walking through a forest. You know, in Germany, forests are really important to people. So, you know, they live in the forest. You know, their culture is born out of the forest. So that he was walking through a forest, you know, having temporarily died. And he came to like a barn, like a shed. And, you know, it's a typical, the way that some people perceive that time when you left your body at near death or death. That he came to this guy who asked what his name was, and the guy looked in some book. They always say it's a book. These days, if young people die, they find he just logs into a computer and checks your name. He looked into a book. His name wasn't there. So he said, "Oh, you're not supposed to be dead. You better go back." But he said that before you go back, you can actually see how this all works. And so the next person who came, you know, to the bee, you know, see if he really deserved to die or not, was a farmer. And when the farmer came up, you know, the guy, "What's your name?" "Oh yeah, you know, your time's up, time you did." "But," said the guy who was with the book, and he said, "You know, have you ever killed anything, animals? He said, "Oh, no, maybe one or two, but no more than that." And the guy looked at this little kid and said, "You see, even though he's dead, he still lies through his teeth. He was a farmer, he killed many animals." But as they were, you know, just talking to this farmer to see where he was going to go, there was another man walked right past the shed, right past, and went up to what the little kid thought was heaven. And the kid said to the guy, "Aren't you going to stop him and ask him what he's been doing?" And that's when this judge told this little kid, throughout that man's whole life, he hasn't judged anybody. Therefore, we're not going to judge him. And that's what the kid came back with. And that's why I remembered that story. The rest of it is just feeling true or not. In the sort of out-of-body experience, sometimes you create a lot of things, but the important stuff, if you don't judge other people, you don't tend to judge yourself. So all this, you know, this judging yourself, thinking you're not good enough, That also I noticed, that meant I was always judging other people as well. You know, you're not good enough, pretty enough, rich enough, kind enough, working hard enough. Have you ever found that? The more critical you are of other people, the more critical you are of yourself. The two always go together. And that made a very good reflection for me. Because I figured out, and it's absolutely true, that people are always putting you down, criticizing you, giving you a hard time, like it could be your boss at work. If they give you a hard time, I guarantee 100% in their personal moments, they also give themselves a hard time. How you regard others is how you regard yourself. How you treat others is how you treat yourself. And that was how I understood His Holiness the Dalai Lama's quote, that if you're having a difficult time with your boss at work, remember you only have to stay with him for 40 hours a week. He has to stay with himself 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of his life. So have some pity on him. You know, you only have 40 hours of suffering. He has 24/7 suffering, or she, whichever gender it is. So that's such an amazing insight. So it means that we can have some compassion and forgiveness to other people if they misbehave and mistreat us, because imagine what they're going through themselves. But if you know how to be kind to yourself, then you can be kind to others. If you're kind to others, then you can be kind to yourself. The two go together. So sometimes if you haven't got no self-esteem, if you think you're hopeless, one of the great things is learn how to be kind to others. Get a cat. Get a dog. Get a little puppy. Get a rabbit. Get a monk. Wouldn't it be wonderful to take a monk home? The old story was, when the first monks went to England, they were worried whether they could afford looking after monks. It's like Buddhist society over there, the English Sangha Trust it was called. And one of the, I think it was the president, no, it wasn't the president, he was one of the members of this little group, trying to find a place for monks when they first went to England. They thought, well, can we afford monks? How many monks can we afford? You know, we only get a few donations. Are monks expensive to look after? And one of the members of the committee, he was a Colin Ash, if he's listening. He's a really nice friend, nice guy. He was a professor of economics at Reading University, if I remember correctly. And he was also an advisor to the Bank of England. You know, he was an economist. So he decided to answer the question, can we afford to look after monks? How much does it cost? He did the math. He crunched the numbers. And he made this wonderful discovery that it is actually much cheaper to look after a monk than to look after a dog. How much money you pay on your dog, looking after it, you know, feeding it, giving it a nice little kennel, and just taking it for walks and taking it to the vet. Actually, the monks and nuns are much cheaper to look after. And I often say there's lots and lots of similarities. You know, the dogs eat out of a bowl, so do we. Dogs, you know, live in these little huts, just like we do. They're called cooties. Dogs are called kennels, but, you know, it's only the size is the only difference. It's not so simple. And dogs, you know, your pet dogs, they never bark. Good monks never bark. You take a nun for a walk, you know, if she had a tail, she'd be wagging it all the time. If we weren't allowed to lick you, we would, because we're kind, we're nice. And even better than a dog or a cat, we can actually teach you some Dhamma. All the dogs and cats can teach you is compassion. Well, they are great teachers. So because of that, he said at the end, when he found out, yes, we can afford them, and number two, realizing how cheap it is to look after a dog or a cat, every home should have one. Look after a monk or a nun. Every home should have one. Wouldn't it be wonderful? You can go to the monk shop or the nun shop and just get a monk or a nun and put them in the back of your house. You know, very easy to feed, one meal a day, take them for a walk in the morning. So, anyhow, it was an expensive. So, it was just, that's one of the reasons as why, that one of the reasons, sorry, why that monks and nuns are very good to be around is because they teach you kindness, just like dogs and cats teach you kindness. So when this old story, this trainee monk, we call them anagarikas, these are people who wear white and precepts, one of which is not eating in the afternoon. No solid food from noon until the following morning. I've been keeping that precept for almost 43 years. And it's amazing, only eating in that small period of the day, still I put on weight. It's really unfair. Yeah, you think that, you know, you don't eat afternoon tea or snacks or dinners, you don't sort of raid the fridge in the middle of the night and you still put on weight. Anyway, I think it's only because I don't worry enough. Because apparently worried people certainly tend to lose weight. But I need to worry some more. So, he came to see me one morning, one of these anagarikas, you know, in quite a few years ago. He hadn't slept all night. And the reason was because he felt guilty. What have you done? And he said, and he was almost crying, afraid. He said, oh, last night, when you'd all gone back to your rooms, I was feeling hungry. So I went into the kitchen. No one was around. I made myself a sandwich. And I ate it! Oh, terrible! You're going to throw me out? And I told him, look, we don't do throwing outs in monastery for simple things like that. And I actually praised him. Well done, you've acknowledged the weakness. And then I said, well, there's advice I can give you. Eat more at lunch. And we also have this huge list of allowables, loopholes, things which you can just slip under the rules by the Buddha, you know, simply because they didn't have the Buddha. And any of you go to the nuns' monastery or the monks' monastery or go and retreat, you see all this cheese and chocolates and sweets and jellies and honeys and fruit juice and carrot juice and all this stuff which you can eat. And people, what's that? Tell them, eat more of that. And he said, yes, but it's not the same as having a sandwich. So I told him, he said, well, you know, just, you get used to it after a while. And he said, and I said, you can go now. And he said, that's not good enough. What's not good enough? You mean you're not going to punish me or give me a penance? He said, I need a penance or a punishment because I've made a big mistake. It's called guilt. What most people experience, you do something wrong, you want to be punished for it. And so I said, no, we don't do punishments in Buddhist monasteries, but you have to, he said. I need it. It's a really weird psychology. So he felt so bad about himself, hadn't slept the night, felt so guilty, he thought having a punishment would get rid of his lack of worth. So I told him, okay, I'll give you a punishment. I had to make one up on the spot. What's a good punishment for somebody, you know, just forgiveness doesn't work? So it just happened that morning, just by chance. I'd been reading a book, quite a well-known book, by the author Philip Hughes, called The Fatal Shore, set in the early years of colonial Australia, when the prisoners, the convicts who were sent over here, if they made a small mistake, If they broke any rule or law, they were flogged with the cat of nine tails. I've just been reading that. It's brutal. But I said, well, you asked for a punishment. I'm going to give you 50 strokes of the cat. And you should have seen this poor guy. You know when people get really afraid, their lips start to quiver and they go all white? That's what he did. You know, he had so little understanding of Buddhism. He really thought that me as the abbot was going to flog him. And he was really scared. I could read his mind. That is not what I was asking for. Something else, please. I said, no, 50 strokes of the cat is your punishment. And I explained what that means. Because at that time, in the monastery down at Serpentine, we had two cats. I said, find one of them. Anyone will do. One stroke. Two. Three. You have to learn some kindness. And one of the best teachers of kindness is to stroke a cat, you know, who's on your lap. Or, you know, stroke the dog. Because that will teach you some kindness. I say, that is your punishment. 50 strokes of the cat. And he got it. So he took the cat, stroked it, and he learned how to forgive himself. Now that is actually how we learn how to love ourselves, by learning to love another being. To look at another being, be kind to them, and maybe generate enough kindness we can show the same emotion to ourselves. Which means we don't have a lack of self-esteem. We learn that from our relationships with things like animals. But, even more important to that, why don't people have, you know, goodwill towards themselves? And if they don't have the kindness towards, you can learn kindness towards yourself by being kind towards animals, or being kind towards your kid, or, you know, being kind towards your favourite monk. I don't know, but you can also learn how to be kind to others by being kind. Because people who are rude, cruel, malicious to other people, it's usually they do the same to themselves. There's something wrong in their psyche. And so this particular story, I actually forget where I got this from, but I used this story recently and also a few minutes ago before I came in here, which is why I'm giving this talk. And it was the story of the seven monks meditating in a cave. This is in Opening the Door of Your Heart. And I had great fun telling this story when I was in the USA a couple of years ago. And listening to me was a bishop, an Episcopalian bishop, you know, similar to an Anglican bishop. And I told this because I was being a little bit cheeky, see if I can catch him out. He fell into the trap, but he thanked me for it afterwards. And he said, can I please use this in my sermon? I said, oh, please do. And it was a story of the seven monks meditating in a cave. They were meditating on loving kindness, which I hope you all know. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings, without distinction, without discrimination on species or race, gender, sexual orientation, my loving kindness goes to everyone. And the seven monks meditating in this cave, listen carefully, because there's a question coming at the end. And if you've heard it before, you have to promise to please shut up. Don't spoil my fun. So the seven monks were the head monk, the boss, the abbot. The second monk was his best friend. They'd grown up together, they loved each other, just like the third monk, who was his brother. They loved each other. The fourth monk, however, even though they ordained, he called him his enemy. They just had personality clash. They just didn't get on. Even though they were really good people, they just, you know, whenever one said one thing, it just always grated on the other. You know, good people, they still can't get on. I see that, you know, quite often when people come to marriage counselling. really good people, why don't you get on? That's something I can still kind of understand. You see the woman, the wife, she's just a beautiful girl, known her a long time. See the guy, an amazing fella. Just me getting into bad habits, that's all. So this was a typical bad habit. This monk, two monks, that didn't get on together. And the fifth monk, number five, was a very old monk. He's so old, so advanced in years, he could die any day. You know, just waiting for just his last breath. And the next monk was, you know, also, he was a sick monk, very ill, so ill, and they never thought he would recover, that no monk would know who was going to die first, the old monk or the sick monk. They were both at the end of their life. And the last monk, number seven, is what we call the useless monk. The useless monk, whenever they tried to meditate, he would always be the first one to fall asleep, which wasn't that bad, but he'd snore really loudly. Whenever they did any chanting, he would always chant out of key, if he could remember the words anyway. And even when he was wearing his robe always tended to fall off. I wonder what that useless monk is. And he was a useless monk. And as I often say when I mention this part of the story, and this is actually true, every monastery has one. You can find out who it is. No, I'm not going to. He's a good monk. He's supposed to be my attendant for the weekend. If I didn't say that, he wouldn't feed me. Look after me. No, I have the panya. Nunneries as well, the same. They always have the useless one. But anyway, had the useless monk was number seven. And what happened next was these gang of robbers, these thieves. They found this cave deep in the jungle. And they thought, this is a great place for our hideout. After we've robbed and maybe killed, we can take all of our loot, all of our stolen goods, into this cave. You know, they didn't have money laundering in those days. I was going to say sort of overseas banks, Panama, but I bet get in trouble for that. So they didn't have overseas banks in those days, so they just had to hide their, you know, ill-gotten goods. This is a brilliant place to hide our goods, and also had found it first. So, let's kill all the monks. So none of the monks can say the location of this cave to the police. That was what they wanted to do. But their senior monk was such a great talker, so convincing. If he hadn't taken the robes, he could have been the treasurer of a country like us. I better not go further in that one either. So, the senior monk managed to talk and convince the head of the thieves to letting all the monks go except one. Because the only reason he wanted to kill everybody is so that, or kill all the monks, is so they didn't tell where the location of the cave was. And so the head monk said, look, we're monks, we keep our promises, we won't tell the location of the caves, let us go. And the head bandit said, no, I've got to be sure. I'm going to make an example. I'm going to kill one of the monks in front of the rest of you, in front of the other six, as a warning. Because if you tell the location of this cave, we'll find you, we'll come for you, and the same will happen to you. And that's the best deal the head monk could do. That one of them had to be killed in front of the others, so the rest could go free. So now the question is, who was chosen? And before you answer, I've got to go through the list again. Head monk, brother, best friend, enemy, old monk, sick monk, both at the end of their lives. Anyway, it was a day or two, you know, 60, 70 years matter. And lastly, the useless monk. And the useless monk had never done anything for anybody, never done any good karma in his whole life. Maybe this was his chance. So if you were the head monk, who would you choose? Answer? If you know the answer, please be quiet. Don't spoil it. Who did he choose? Thank you for that wrong answer, because that's what the bishop said. And when I tell the story, that's what most people say. He sacrificed himself. And that is the wrong answer. But there's a reason why I tell this story, which is coming up soon. Any other suggestions? Who else? Anyone for the useless monk? Yeah, at the back. I thought that. No, of course not. The answer is, and those people have heard the story, a very good story once you find out what the answer is and why the meaning of telling this story. The answer was that the head monk's love for his brother was no more, no less than the love for the best friend. If you love two people just the same, you just can't choose between them. And his love towards the enemy was no more, no less than the other two. Even the old monk and sick monk and the useless monk, he loved everybody equally. He just couldn't judge between them, no matter who they were and who they did, what they did. His love was unconditional, all beings, no matter what gender, what race, what religion, what they did or what they didn't do. His love was given to everybody equally. And most importantly, his love towards himself was no more, no less than his love to all the other six monks. And that's where I told the bishop, I said, didn't your teacher, Jesus, tell you to love your neighbour as yourself? He said, yeah. Well, doesn't that mean to love yourself as your neighbour? No more, no less. That's what the word as means. To love your neighbour as yourself means to love yourself as your neighbour equally. Yes, he said. He gave me the Buddhist respect. He said, and that's why he wants to teach that, you know, in his sermons. Because when you learn how to love yourself no more, no less than everybody else, no matter who they are, then you understand what we mean by unconditional love. A love which doesn't judge all beings, no matter who they are. And that unconditional love has to include yourself. That's why I tell the story, because most people, especially in the Western culture, they don't love themselves. Other people, yep. You can sacrifice yourself for the poor, for the sick. So many nurses, they sacrifice themselves for their patients, but they never take a rest for themselves. They treat other people with such kindness and such giving, but they never give that to themselves. Which is why people have burnout. So when you realize that we treat ourselves no more, no less than other people, that we count as well. The idea of sacrifice, personal sacrifice, other people come first, just disappears. You count. You are important. You should love yourself as well. Not judge yourself. It's so wonderful when you don't judge yourself, when you just accept yourself as you are. When you don't try and improve, this is Ajahn Brahm, take it or leave it, but I never fake it. You know, I often thought that being a public speaker, sometimes that, am I just one thing in front of you guys and another thing when I'm by myself? Oh, it's the monks. Am I nice, peaceful and happy, telling jokes? Is that what I'm like, you know, when we're just by ourselves? He better say that, otherwise he'll get 50 strokes. Because I really feel for people who try and be something they're not, because they don't like themselves, because they're trying to improve, they haven't got kindness and love and compassion towards themselves. That must be a terrible world to live in, when you're just trying to fake it. So, when you love yourself, you forgive yourself. But I remember, when I was a kid, they always said, don't love yourself, just become proud and big-headed. And that is totally wrong. When you're kind to yourself, when you respect yourself, when you have kind and compassion, love towards yourself, you don't get big-headed. You get big stomach. No, you get big-hearted. So never say you get big-headed, you get big-hearted. That changes the ball game. You're encouraged to be kind to yourself. You're encouraged to love yourself, to respect yourself. And a practical way of doing that, already mentioned it earlier, first time I was starting meditation, it's not just about sitting down on the ground, meditating, because sometimes people get too serious. My first teacher gave me one of the most powerful meditation techniques I've ever practiced, because I did practice it for 2 years. He said, in order to be kind to yourself, in order to learn how to love yourself, he said, when you get up in the morning, first thing, go and have a look in the mirror at the bathroom and smile at yourself. That's what he told me to do. And I argued, I resisted. At that time I was a student. You go out late at night. You know what it's like when you first get up in the morning? You feel terrible. You can't smile at yourself in that time of the morning. Especially those days, you know, just going to the pub with your friends, you know, getting a bit drunk, and you felt even worse in the morning. I wasn't born a monk. Stupid what I did when I was a young man, but at least I know it was stupid by personal experience, not by theory. So, in the bathroom, trying to smile at myself, I said, I can't do it. And that's where the teacher told me, if you can't manage a natural smile, get the two fingers on the side of your mouth and push up. And that was an exercise in learning how to love myself. Even first thing in the morning when it was most difficult, when you felt terrible. And what had happened is I saw this stupid young student making a face at himself in the mirror. And that made me smile back. And I smiled even more, and the guy in the mirror smiled even more. And every morning for 2 years I ended up laughing at myself. Laughing at yourself, loving yourself. The two words are so close together in English, and there's a good reason for that. If you live a life of love, there's a lot of laughter between the two of you. If you don't live a life of love, is there any laughter? There's just criticism. So a lot of times, that learning how to laugh at yourself is so close to learning how to respect and love yourself. That's why that method really worked. I learned how to love myself, no matter what happened, by learning how to laugh at myself. And when I learn how to love myself, accept myself, then it's so easy to accept other people. And of course, the last little anecdote, which is even more powerful, to learn about unconditional love for others, it was an old story, but I love repeating it because we were doing a ceremony the other day for, you know, it's in the Thai New Year day for, you know, departed relations. And so when we did a little ceremony here, that was April the 16th. That's only, how long ago was that? It's only about 2 weeks ago, 9 days, so why that one quick? That we were supposed to, I was telling other people to do this, and I did it myself, remembering your parents who passed away. It's an opportunity to remember them. We call it sharing merits with them. But at least I remembered my mother, especially my father, and just how much he taught me, even though he's been dead 50 years now. Actually, 50 years next month. I never forget him. Never will. Especially some of the beautiful things he said to me. One of which was that great story which fits in here taking me aside in his old second-hand, just about managing to go car. He'd probably be banned from the roads if it was on the roads in West Australia these days. He was a very poor man. Taking me aside, I still remember the place in Acton, just off Churchfield Road. I remember it just to this day. I'm looking at it now, even the colour of the car was green. And he stopped the car, turned around to me, and he said, "Son, whatever happens to you in your life," I was about 13 at the time, "whatever happens to you in your life, however you turn out, please, I want you to remember this." You know, I did remember this so clearly. He said, "Whatever you do in your life, wherever you go, however you turn out, the door of my house will always be open to you. It will always be open to you. I never shut the door in your face. You're always welcome." Only 13. Didn't really understand how deep that meaning was. Only later on, when you became a monk. One of the nice things about being a monk or nun, especially as the young monk or nun, you have so much time. You can reflect, figure things out, understand what these things mean. And that's where, you know, in Thailand, I remembered that and understood what it meant was the door of his heart was open to me. Not his house, his heart. Oh, that was just such a beautiful, beautiful teaching. It was unconditional love. Telling me, "Son, whatever you do, you turn out to be a criminal. You turn out to be something which, you know, most people will be embarrassed about. But not me. The door of my heart is always open to you. You're my son, that's enough. Whatever you do." And that so inspired me. Because it was expression of unconditional love. And I've done my best to live by that creed, really beautiful creed. Whoever I see, I give them unconditional love. No matter what they say to me, how they deal with me, what they do, the door of my heart's always open to you. Even if you mistreat me and make me give a talk for a long time, and after the talk stop me going to the toilet because you've got all your questions, I'll still come back next week. I know I'm exploited, I know I'm taken advantage of, but that's the purpose of my life, to be taken advantage of. So I don't resist it, I accept it. But it's beautiful when you have this wonderful door of your heart's open, no matter who you are, no matter what you did. And when I practice that to other people, you know, I also practice it to myself. Whoever you are, whatever you've done, open the door of your heart up to yourself. And that was this next incredible moment. I say that everybody does this, sooner or later. Usually in a private moment of your life, when you feel comfortable in a spiritual place. It doesn't have to be a church or a monastery or a temple. Sometimes it's in the forest or by the beach when you're by yourself, sitting down. You remember these words. And just, you know, as the surf rolls in, you close your eyes and say, "Me, this person I've known all my life." You can remember just how old you are and where you've come from and all the difficulties, the problems and the joy you've been through in your life so far. "Me, the door of my heart is open to me. No matter what I've done, how I've behaved, what's happened to me, my life, some wonderful moments, some tragic, really hard moments, I open the door of my heart to me. Come in." And that's where you, in one moment, you forgive yourself. You realize you're not such a bad person. And you love yourself unconditionally, just like my father did. Just like a dog does, your favorite dog. It's just always so happy when you come home. A little cat, so happy when you feed it. I know cats. But that's their nature, and you're happy to have them there. And that's when you open your heart to yourself. It's an amazing experience. You know, you're beginning to not judge yourself. That's why it's unconditional. You're at peace with yourself. And it's always so incredibly positive. There's no bad side effects to forgiving yourself, loving yourself, accepting yourself as you are. Not needing to improve. Not needing to do anything better. You are good enough. And people say, well, there'll be no progress in this world if everybody thinks like that. Oh, how wonderful. Why do we want progress? But you'll never get anywhere. Who wants to go anywhere in the first place? Isn't this place good enough? But you'll never be testing yourself. I've been testing myself for too long. But you'll never be rich. Oh, crikey, thank goodness I was never rich. All the rich people I've known always really screwed up. Honestly, I've known many rich people. This quickly, I've got to finish off soon. The lady, she's probably gone now. I hope she has anyway, because being that rich, you know, she can probably sue me. She had this huge house in Shelley. I'd never seen such a huge house because she asked me to come over to bless it. And but as soon as I went in there, just travelling all the way from Serpentine, I said, I need to go to the toilet. And she said, well, it's easier if I draw you a map. And that's what she did. I mean, this was a huge mansion. So she had to draw a map to find a way to the toilet. And, you know, is there 13 or 14 bedrooms or something? Huge house. And just making conversation, I asked her how many people live. She said, only me. Oh, and that was just such a shock to me. Well, this huge house and only you live there. Why? She said, because I'm so afraid of my relations and friends asking me for some of my wealth. They always come here and they ask me, can I borrow this? I'm starting a new business. I'm a bit short, you know, can I borrow some money? Such a rich person, they never saw her, they just saw her wealth. And so she had to live by herself. She was a prisoner of being mega wealthy. If you ever gone to these big houses, there's one really rich person I went to go and see in Kuala Lumpur. And, you know, he had guards on his house, bars on his windows, security everywhere, just like a person staying in a prison. I don't know, was that to keep people out or keep people in? So, sometimes you become a prisoner of wealth, but you don't need to be wealthy. You are all good enough. And are you pretty enough, handsome enough, rich enough? Are you enlightened enough? If you don't know the story of opening the door of your heart, you'll never be enlightened. You'll never be at peace. You'll always be trying to get something else. You never think you're good enough. You have to improve. You have to do something more. Which means you can never take a break. You can never take a rest. So this is how to restore your self-esteem. To restore your feeling of self-worth. To love yourself no more, no less than other people. So you never need to sacrifice yourself. You do really treat yourself as you treat all others. No more, no less. I treat you as I treat myself. Sometimes in my room, I try bad jokes before I try them out on you. And sometimes I laugh at my own jokes. So much so that once, were you there at the time? I was laughing at my own joke, and I laughed so much I was choking. And poor old Ajahn Bhamali thought, I need to go and see a doctor. I thought he was going to go. So, see if you can learn how to open the door of your heart. To realize that, you know, you're not half as bad as your mother told you were. Don't trust otherwise people. Trust someone like myself. Trust the Buddha. Trust the, even Jesus. Okay. To love yourself as your neighbor. No more, no less. Then you'll find a lot of peace in your life. Thank you for listening. Very good. That wasn't the best starters, but it's good enough in the circumstances. Okay, some questions from overseas. If there are any tonight, yeah, there are. Those of you who want to go, it's good enough. So you don't offend me. Some of you got to go to the toilet, you got to go check something or other. But anyway, those who want to linger around for the dessert, which is the question, that's coming soon. Here it comes. Okay, very good. From Cairns, from USA, or from Mauritius. Mauritius is a beautiful island. There, one from Mauritius. Is divorce karmic? What about remarriage after divorce? Is that karmic? Karmic? Well, I don't know exactly what you mean by karmic. But, you know, is it like the karma, you're with a person for such a long time, and then it just passes? Is that predestined? Not like karma from a past life, it's usually karma from this life. You know, if, you know, you get divorced, it must be like the karma of your husband having an affair. That's karma, the karma of this life. Or often it's the karma that you never put enough, wisdom and love into that relationship. This was a simile I don't know, I give this every other week. The glass is cracked. Can you see the crack in the glass? I gave this at a funeral recently. Can you see the crack in the glass in the front? Because the crack is microscopic. That's why you can't see it. But it's there. This actually came from Ajahn Chah, this story. The crack is there because if I drop this, or someone else kicks it, it will break. It's the crack of impermanence. Anicca. I know this won't last. Because this won't last, because it's impermanent, that's why I care for it. I can't kick it or mistreat it. It will break. But if this was plastic, if it was unbreakable, permanent, I wouldn't need to care for it. I could kick it, drop it, squash it, and it would just rebound again. Being unbreakable. It's because it's breakable, that's why we care. Because relationships won't last. They're cracked from the very beginning. That's why we care for them. Always looking after them, just like we look after this cup or this glass, because we know it's fragile. Your body is fragile, it's cracked. One day it will break, you will die. That's why we care for it. So the idea of marriage, divorce, being karmic, is because we never realized really that much is cracked. We should have taken better care of it. Remarriage after divorce, is that karmic? Yeah, sometimes you meet somebody else. Who was it? That's actually one of the stories which Ajahn Sumedho told me a long time ago. He went to visit his home in Seattle, he was brought up, and he caught up with an old school friend of his, and the old school friend, "Oh great, you're here, I'm just about to get married, please come to my marriage ceremony." He said, "No, you're getting old now, why are you getting married? No, this is not my first marriage, this is my ninth." He said, or something like that, he said, "Why are you getting married again 9 times? He said, "Well, look, it's like this. I like meeting a new guy. Now, dating is really exciting. And then falling in love. And that moment when he goes down on one knee and he proposes, I love that moment. It's just so beautiful, so romantic. And planning the wedding, you know, and getting all the guests in and a nice dress. I love that stuff. And the wedding itself, where we look at each other with just really dewy eyes, smiling, he looks so handsome and I have to dress up, look so beautiful, and we exchange our vows, That is so beautiful. I love that. It's what happens afterwards I don't like. So, we end that one, start all over again. The coffee, the engagement, the sort of excitement about getting married, and then do that. This is my 9th time. You know, she had a point, I reckon. I wouldn't encourage it, but you can understand where she was coming from. So remarriage after all, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen. Because the main story was, if you're single, you have single person suffering. When you get married, you have married person suffering. It's just changing like one type of suffering for another type of suffering. So don't think the suffering's going to get away. And people say, well, what about if we don't get married anymore, we don't get divorced, we become a monk or a nun? And then you have monk or nun suffering. You can't get away. Ajahn Bhang, can you give me some advice on making a difficult decision? Yeah, toss a coin. But if you read my book, you toss a coin. Tails, I get divorced. Oh no, you can't get divorced until you're married. Heads, I marry her. Tails, I don't. And the point is, once it comes up heads, how do you feel? Heads, I marry her. Do you think 2 out of 3? In other words, you're not happy with the decision. Then of course, what that's telling you is how you feel inside. If it comes up heads, I marry her. Yes. That means you really want to do it in the first place. So tossing a coin is just finding out what you really want to do. So you make a decision, heads I go left, tails I go right. After you've tossed the coin, how do you feel? What's the emotion inside? It's just getting that intuition up to your brain. Lastly, how, as a layperson, how do I consider I am good enough and find the middle way when it comes to entertainment, relationship and a job? Look, if you feel you're good enough, you have what's called you're confident. In a job, you come across as confident. And even in entertainment, just like me, I'm confident I can tell good jokes. Because I always remember, it was Bob Hope, he said, you know, that when he started off as a comedian, people used to throw tomatoes and eggs at him. He said if they hadn't have thrown all that stuff at him in the early days, he would have had nothing to eat. So there's always a positive side of what's going on. So if you think you're good enough, most of life is about confidence. If you get that confidence, I'm good enough. I'm not the best. That's being just so conceited and also negligent. But, you know, I'm good enough. You can usually get away with anything. What I've got away with in my life, I'm just really surprised. You know, being so confident. That sort of show I went on radio, on 6PR I think it was, and as a show on adult themes, 10 to 12, people actually ringing up with their sexual dysfunctions, problems in marriage. Imagine asking a celibate monk about that. But I was confident. So I didn't know what I was talking about, but I was confident. Much of my life has been like that. All the other time, that was just recently, 2 years ago, giving the keynote address at the 2015 World Computer Congress in South Korea. What do I know about computers? You know, look, Sol, you're an IT guy. Honestly, do I know really much about computers? He said stuff all, and that's, I agree with you. But it doesn't stop me. I go up there in front of all these executives of Google and Samsung and LG. I say, oh, great talk. It's confidence, that's what it is. So anyway, that's why, if you think you're good enough, you become good enough. But it doesn't stop there. This is the amazing thing. If you think you're good enough, that's where you start to grow and get better and better and better and better. You improve beyond your wildest imaginations. But if you think there's something wrong with you, you're lacking in something. That, you know, that you were born with, you know, lacking a few of the three robes, that you are, you know, a bit short. That means that you know, you few sutras short of the Tripitaka, or something like that. If you think like that, you become like that. But if you're confident, it's amazing you can achieve anything. So when you think you're good enough, actually you get better. When you think you need to improve, you get worse. So don't try and improve yourself. You're good enough. And then you get better. So, any questions from here before we finish off? Already gone over time. I'm enjoying myself. How was the talk this evening? Was it good enough? Very good. Thank you. Very good. Have a nice evening. Oh, that's what we do. Bowing, don't we? It's a couple of weeks since I've been here. I keep forgetting. So now pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṁ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangam Namami.